Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What's up, everybody? It's your coach. Welcome back to the Coach HP channel. You see me throwing punches like this because today, on today's show, we have, listen, I'm a lover, not a fighter. On today's show, we have the one and only director of communication from Showtime. He involved with boxing, was involved in The Zone, was involved with HBO Sports, was involved with the MLB, rose to the top through all adversity, lost his parents at a young age. Nothing makes me more prouder to present to you guys this episode with my brother, my boy, Greg Domino. Please, if you haven't yet, subscribe to the channel that's bringing you endless passion over and over and over again. All walks of life. I don't care if you're an author, an entrepreneur, an athlete, a politician, whoever it is, we're gonna find you, bring you on the show. Episode 97 of the Coach HP Show with Greg Domino. Let's go. Three, two, one, boom, and we are on. Greg, to me, man, the amount of respect I have for you and the passion that I see in what you have, in everything that you do, bro, where did that come from, man?
I really appreciate that, first of all, and thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate I'm always on the other side of these things. I'm the one setting them up usually. It's come from a life of ups and downs, and you know, you get forced into situations where you need to prevail and you need to work hard, and passion comes from that hard work. And I'm fortunate enough to work in a field that's fun. I never complain about my job. Sometimes my wife, you know, wants me to complain about it, and I'm like, yeah, how can you complain when you love what you do? So it's easy, and I'm fortunate to have landed where I have.
Dude, I see a lot of giant stuff back there. Is Lawrence Taylor the greatest giant of all time?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, he has to be. I mean, I was so young when he was playing, but his memory lives on so strongly. He was amazing. Best giant ever, but I did have this argument the other day that as you'll see over this shoulder, Odell, even though his stint was short and his flame may have burned out a little bit since his time with the Giants, I feel like he has to be the most talented, gifted, like physically gifted player to ever touch the field in East Rutherford.
Do you still follow, now thinking about it, is it Steve Weatherford, the ex-punter now turned like motivational guy, whatever? Do you follow his stuff at all or no?
Oh, Weatherford, right? Yeah. No, I did follow him for a while. I think I still follow him on Instagram, but he's a good dude. I mean, you know, I love the people who have turned a career on the field into something bigger off the field. He's a good dude, and I mean, has there ever been a punter who is in better shape than
no? That guy's out of control. You got to see him now. That dude now is insane. He's out of control. He's whatever he's on. I think he's on the same thing as The Rock, bro. Those guys are on the same cocktail.
And hey, I need one of those. That's what I need.
It's out of control, bro. Is your nemesis number one? Is it the Jets?
No, it's the NFC East. It's the whole. I mean, now it's the. It used to be the Cowboys for a long time, but now it's got to be the Eagles. It's just something about Eagles fans since they started winning, and when they won their Super Bowl, it all just shifted, and we're so close in proximity, right? Like we're 90 miles down the 95 here. My friend who I have season tickets with, his name is Matt, my best friend forever. He lives down in Philly. So like whenever I go down and see him, we get that dose of just, you know, Eagles stuff everywhere. But the good thing is they're not very good either right now. No one in the NFC East is really. So
Greg, when you're down there, do you rock your Giants stuff or you go neutral?
Hard. No, I rock it everywhere. Everywhere. It's always been my thing. Even when I was like younger, and my friend, he used to live up in Boston too before he lived in Philly. And I would go up to Boston. I'd wear my Yankees hat proudly everywhere. I'd get taunted and, you know, you'd have the verbal altercations. But like, it's part of being a fan. You gotta represent wherever you are.
Are you bigger Yankees or Giants?
Giants as evidenced by this basement. But you know, being a Yankee fan is a little different. Like there's no chip on our shoulder, right? I think that's something that can extend to just being a human in any walk of life. But like, as a Yankee fan, there's not much of a chip on your shoulder. We were so successful as an organization, 27 World Series, and you know, a laundry list of players. I was arguing with someone who's a Mets fan the other day. I'm like, Did the Yankees get to about their 25th best player ever before we hit the best Met of all time? And it's just, there's no comparison there. So being a Giants fan, you have the chip on your shoulder. There's more of it. With the Yankee fan, you just, if you have a bad season, you're like, you know, what's a bad season when you're so successful?
Who is the best Met of all time, by the way?
I don't know. Is it Tom Seaver?
Probably. It's
right.
Because Nolan Ryan, even though he started with the Mets, didn't.
Right.
Didn't end too long, so it would probably be.
Mike Piazza. I mean, they idolize Mike Piazza, but even him.
Yeah, but he's a Dodger. He started off as a Dodger, right? He blew off. Yeah, of course they idolize him. He blew up as a Dodger, dude. I think because even the team that was heavy stacked in the '80s had a lot of people that fell off, man. That they didn't go where they should have gone, you know. So yeah, you're right, dude. Because even look, Gary Carter, who was a beast, didn't pop off. Strawberry, Dwight Gooden, all those guys. You know, even Keith Hernandez, who was good, never got to that status, bro.
Yeah,
you man, you're. By the way, you've sent me the best bio in the history, bro. I know. When I saw you do that, I go, this guy is efficient and he crushes it as his job. We have a lot of similarity. We have a lot of differences, but a lot of similarities, man. I had an uncle who had the same thing your dad had.
Okay.
And I'm sure is that something that you developed during life or you're born with?
My dad was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when he was 27. It was around the same time that he had me.
He was normal before?
Yeah, he was normal. He was played football through high school and, you know, worked a job with his hands, labor. So like it was in, you know, taking away from that. And then, even then I didn't really see it start to affect him till maybe I was 10. So maybe, you know, 10 years after I was born. He started, you know, needing to use a cane and all of this sort of thing, because it's a degenerative disease. It just takes time to develop. I know some other people who have had it and have fought against it. And I guess everyone is different, but like, I know a guy who has MS has had it for 10 years and runs marathons, you know? So, sometimes you succumb to different injuries. Like my dad, he started using cane around like when I was around 10, and then around like 13 or 14, he had an accident at work and like fell out of a truck and broke his arm, broke his leg. And then he was never really able to regain the use of that arm or that leg in the same way, just because of the illness. It's, I don't think you're born with it, but I think, you know, it can be genetic, and something that I always have in the back of my mind, like, you know, if it's genetic, let me maximize every day I have on this earth, you know?
Hell yeah, bro. Hell yeah. You growing up, man, seeing your dad in that kind of shape, was your dad the kind of guy that he was with you 24/7? Was he absent because he was working all the time? How was he?
No, my dad was always, my dad was amazing. Can't say enough of that. I lived with my dad. My parents got divorced. I lived with my dad from like 7 on. And he worked a lot. He was a volunteer fireman. And then he worked in a fire related, like filling up fire extinguishers and that sort of thing, like inspecting fire extinguishers. And he always worked in that field. And you know, he worked, but he would I remember him taking me to work, and you know, I was filling CO2 tanks and all that stuff. He was always around, and you know, he had a motorcycle, and you know, do yard work and manual labor and all, like, you know, just always, I was always with him. So he was always a presence, you know, in my life.
When he started to get sick, Greg, did that affect you at all?
Yeah, it definitely did. It definitely did, because he was like, you know, he's the coach of my baseball team and the coach of my football team as a kid. And as a coach, you understand like how intimate that is. Cause like, yeah, you know, the coach is, when you're the coach's son, right, it's different. So you have, you know, 10 or 11 of your friends, your best friends in the neighborhood, there with you. And, you know, you see your dad, now he has a cane, and, you know, a 10-year-old, you know, either you're like the bully who's like, oh, what the hell's wrong with him? Or, you know, like, oh man, his dad is sick, don't say anything. It definitely affected me a little bit, because I just saw what he was going through, and he was such an active, you know, he had a motorcycle, he's always taking me out to do things, yeah, and he was so active in my life. And then, you know, it just started to whittle away at him over time. And one thing that I always struggled with then, that I've come to terms with now, is like, I was, you know, 14 years old, whatever, not really able to understand like why he was succumbing to the disease and like letting it overpower him. Like, I remember the day that he got a wheelchair, like it was yesterday, right? It was like, I was like, why, you don't need that. You don't need that. Right. And he did, you know, I was like, no, just like, you know, power through, you know. And I have that same mentality now about like myself, like, you know, I love to run. And it's like, if I feel like a nagging, you know, my hamstring or something, I'm like, no, I'm going to run through that. Like, nothing can stop me, you know, like, and yeah, then you try to extend that mentality to everywhere, every, you know, different parts of your life. It's, you know, working too many hours a day, like, no, I can finish this today. Those sort of things. So it did affect me that he, you know, he had that. And, but you know, it taught me a lot about myself in the process.
Absolutely, bro. See, I was the worst, man. I mean, the reverse. I wish I would have seen my dad in a case, because my dad prepared me for everything in life, bro, except to deal with him. This dude beat the shit out of me, like, a lot, because I used to fail in baseball and I was one of the best, but he just couldn't take it, dude. And his, like, he would peacock through my baseball thing. That was like his thing, you know? And he had me trapped with him 24/7. And I hated to go with him to places, because we'd always go to the stupidest places in the world, Home Depot, like places that I don't step foot in as an adult, man. So I always, man, I'm always empathetic and curious to see other kids that they don't have that presence over them like I did, bro. Like, I couldn't even grow out my hair. I couldn't even have a beard or something, because my dad was controlling of everything, dude. So it's interesting that you have that that point of view, man. When you graduate high school, you start thinking of college. What do you want to do with your life? What are you thinking about back then?
Yeah, it's a good one, because I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think I had like one mission when I was in high school, because I wasn't really a great student, and it was a work ethic thing. It wasn't even like I didn't have the chops to do it. I just didn't really want to do it. But my goal was like, I just need to get into a college and get out of this town. I lived in a little suburban town in North Jersey, and you know, had a lot of friends who, you know, I grew up with, and I just saw the development of a lot of friends, and I just saw, like, I just don't want to, you know, I'll stay in touch with who I need to stay in touch with, and I still do to this day. And I have a lot of friends back home, but, you know, I saw the development of a lot of my close friends, and I saw them going down rabbit holes of, you know, not wanting to go to college, not, you know, getting into drugs and whatnot. And I was like, I just need to get the hell out of here. And wherever I can get accepted to college wise, that's where I'm going. And I got accepted to a couple of colleges and end up staying in New Jersey, because the financial aid was much better to stay in New Jersey. And so that's what I did. But you know, I didn't know I wanted a career in sports. Of course, you say that, but I was like, you know, I don't know what I really want to do. So it's funny though, when I went to college, I realized I was strong in English, but I didn't really want to sit around and read Hamlet, you know, for 4 years.
Fuck Shakespeare, bro.
Right. Like, what am I gonna do? Like, what am I gonna write a book? I didn't. So I was like, they said, if you don't want to do that, do communication. So I did that for a year. But then I had this like switch that went off. I was like, I just want to be rich. So I just went pre-law, and I was like, if I'm become a lawyer, all I know, like, lawyers are rich. So if I can become a lawyer, then I can become, I'll be rich too.
You took the LSAT and everything or no?
No, I didn't. I took my, I went pre-law at St. Peter's where I went to college, and I took my first two law classes and I hated it. And I had some, St. Peter's is a Jesuit school in New Jersey with most of the teachers, professors are Jesuit, older Jesuit priests. And, wow. Their teaching style is efficient. But when it came to law, it was just like, I realized pretty quickly, like, this isn't the right decision. Right. Like right. That was one of the first moments in my life where I was like, being rich, yes, that's definitely the goal, is to not be where I was as like a kid and not, you know, I want more for myself and my future kids. But I just realized like, law isn't what I want to do. So I stayed with the pre-law cause I was already kind of into it. There's a political science degree. And then I went to I got a job at a law firm, also hated it. And then went to my career counselor one day and I was like, hey, can you help me get another job? Cause I hate this law job. I hate my law classes and I don't want anything to do with it. And she helped, she was like, you know, we just got we just had this former alumni come in here from Major League Baseball and he's trying to get an internship in the PR department over there. And I know you used to be communication. So would you be interested in applying? And I was like, absolutely. I went and applied and I got the job interview and then went on vacation for 2 weeks. And I remember being in Nicaragua with my now wife and every day going to like the internet cafe to check my email to see if I got the job. And like the last day of the vacation, I check in, they offered me the job and I was like, it was amazing. And then, you know, it was unpaid and all that, but it was the best decision. It started my whole career in sports.
Dude, you mentioned Nicaragua there now. Are you Spanish?
I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm Irish, Polish, but my wife is from Nicaragua.
You speak Spanish?
A little bit. I wish I knew more. I wish I was better at it. You know, she's helping making sure my kids can speak Spanish. But
right.
I wish I knew more. I know enough to get by with my mother and father-in-law.
Nice, dude. That's nice, yeah. Man. The food you eat at the house, is it Nicaraguan? Do you ever eat Nicaraguan food?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All the time. Yeah.
What's your favorite?
I mean, well, my kids are like, you know, they eat gallo pinto all the time. And you're down in Miami, right?
So I'm Cuban from Miami, bro.
Yes. Yeah,
so there's a restaurant here called Los Ranchos. That's Nicaraguan style. So they have a gallo pinto, they have the churrasco, they have tres leches, the best, bro. Next time you're in Miami, I think
I've been there because every time we go down to Miami, we go to that little area where all the little Nicaraguan restaurants are. And But my wife and my mother-in-law are always making, you know, salpicón and all the other dishes, and I like it. Nice, the thing is, though, when we started dating back in the day, I embraced it too much. I like quickly put on 25 pounds just eating rice every day. It wasn't something I was used to my whole life. I never eaten rice with every meal, and then I was eating. I remember I would just be eating maduros just by the bowl. And then I realized, these things are terrible for you. Don't. So now I'm like the two spoons of rice with the milk to try to like level things out.
Try to chill it out, huh? Dude, yeah. MLB, man. MLB is so interesting because it's winning on one side and I always feel it's losing on the other side. That's where I'm from. I come from the baseball world, man. What did you start doing with MLB?
Yeah, so I got the internship, and what it was I worked in the PR department and at the commissioner's office. This is when Bud Selig was the commissioner, and my number one job was get in there at 6:30 a.m., which was way earlier because I was a college student. I was going into my junior year, and get in there at 6:30 a.m. and print and go through every website of every major newspaper in the United States. So I'd go to San Francisco Chronicle, and I'd go to New York Times, and I'd go to the New York Daily News. And what I would do is have to copy and paste the stories, put them into Microsoft Word, print out about every story from the night before, about 80, 90 pages, take that, fax it to Bud Selig in Milwaukee, because his office wasn't in New York, it was in Milwaukee. So I would literally fax it to him. Then I would go and make about 30-40 copies of this digest and go hand it out to every executive every morning, which was cool because now you're walking into Rob Manfred. This is when he was the COO or some, you know, he was part of the executive suite, but he wasn't the commissioner, you know, every morning. Hey, Rob, how are you? Here you go. And, you know, and now at that point of the day, by 10 o'clock when I'm handing this thing out, like, I know everything that happened in baseball the night before, whether I watched it or not. Like, I knew every story. I knew everything going on. And it was interesting. It's one of those jobs that doesn't exist anymore. No one does this anymore. No one's going into an office and printing out stories and copying, pasting. Like, I don't think it exists. Standing in front of the copy machine trying to figure out how a copy machine works, and because it's always breaking, and it teaches you a lot. And it's interesting because I think you and I both, like, we straddle that line generationally of like pre-internet, but also having internet during like our developing age. I'm 34.
I'm 42, buddy. So I got a little bit. I got a little bit on you, but you're right, because it's a privilege, man, because we understand what it's like before it. I don't know. Do you understand the beeper? Was the beeper there on your
area? My dad had the beeper. Yeah, no, I remember. See? I think I had a beeper, but I don't know if it ever worked. Like, I think he just gave me his old beeper.
The pagers.
But I remember the beeper. The pagers.
He used to hit the codes. The 823 when you were thinking about a chick. 143 when I love you, buddy. You see? Come on. So, but you're right, man, because it gives us perspective on both worlds. Right? How long were you in MLB for?
So I was there about 2 years, and so I was there for a 3-month internship, and then you know, you're a big baseball fan, so it was when the Phillies played the Rays in 2008, the World Series. That was the end of my internship. It was basically through the end of the postseason, and it was they were down in Philadelphia, and my best friend lived down there. He went to Temple, and I was like, hey, can I come to the World Series? And they're like, listen, we can't pay for your train, can't pay for your hotel, but if you find your way there, you can come and work, right? So I, of course, I'm like, all right, let me do that. And
I love that.
To this day, I was very broke. I went and borrowed $50 from my now brother-in-law, and I took the train down to Philadelphia, went to the Philadelphia game. This was the game that don't remember the exact controversy, but I think it got to about the fifth inning and there was a monsoon. And I think the Phillies or the Rays might have been up and they were going to call the game, but then it was like that point where they didn't know if they should call it or resume it. And then I think they called it, and then we just got a flood of bad press because people were saying, like, oh, you can't just make up the rules on the fly here. But during that very long rain delay, I was sitting in this back little room. I wasn't even watching the game on the field. I was in the press box, but in this little room with no windows, watching on a TV, and with a couple of guys from the PR department doing game notes. So, like, you know, this guy is, if you know, his next at bat will be his 100th at bat in the postseason, things like of that nature. We put together those notes, and I'm just kind of a fly on the wall, you know, chiming in when I can. And this woman came in and she goes, you know, Can you hold my purse, my bag, and my umbrella, my bag, my jacket, my umbrella? And I go, yeah, sure, no problem. I know who she was. She was the head of the American League. And so I'm just sitting there basically through this whole rain delay and all this controversy. And my main task is I'm just holding this woman's stuff. And I'm like, she comes back 2-3 hours later. She goes, thank you very much, and hand it to her. And she thanks me profusely and leaves. And I go on my way. And the rest is right. So then I go back to the office, work for a couple weeks, and then her assistant quit, just out of the blue, quit. And I found out, she came to see me. She called me into her office and she goes, "Hey, I know you're an intern here. I can offer you a temp job, no benefits, but it's full time. And I'm now in my senior year of going into my senior year of college, and she's offering me $30,000, no benefits, to work full time, and I'm at my senior year." And thankfully, I was in a position that I was way ahead on credits because I had gone to school all summer, every summer, just kept grinding. So I was in a position that I needed, I don't know, 15 credits or something. I'm like, I'll just go to school at night because I can't turn down a job at Major League Baseball. This is 2000, right. Now 2008, 2009. There's, you know, the recession is happening. People are losing their jobs. And I have this wonderful opportunity. I've got to take it. So I did that. I was there for another about year and a half. So about 2 years total. And then they just never could really get me out of that non-benefit stage. And as a 22-year-old with, you know, no family really, I needed the health insurance. I needed those things that come along with having a corporate job like this. And HBO came through a contact to MLB, and then I made the jump over to HBO, and it was the right move. Working at baseball was amazing. 2009, yeah. I worked on the road for the American League, so I was at every Yankee game, home and away, for the entire 2009 World Series.
No way, dude! That is awesome, man.
The Phil Cuzzy game, the last game at the Metrodome when he made the wrong call, when he called it foul and it was a fair ball.
Yep.
All the way through, you know, CC's amazing performances, A-Rod's, you know, best moments as a
best
as a
years Yankee, of his life.
Yeah, right.
of his life, bro.
Yeah, dude, so that was awesome. It was like a dream come true. Like, you know, being around that team and being around baseball, it was amazing.
HBO comes calling. When HBO comes calling, are you okay? Did you want to get into boxing, or was it just all sports in general?
It was sports, and for that it was like an opportunity. It was like this big, huge company, you know, with all these cool programs. I didn't know what I wanted at that point. I mean, I wanted to just stay at baseball for the rest of my life. All these guys had been there, you know, all these guys and gals that had been there for 20, 30 years. And I'm like, I could do that. Like this guy's a VP. He just sat here for 20 years and he made it to that. Every year he goes to the postseason, the World Series. Like, this is a dream job. And they come calling and it was interesting because my dad was a boxing fan as a kid. Tyson fan. Like, I remember watching Tyson fights on pay-per-view on a little black box back in the day. And I had just bought tickets to Cotto Foreman, Yuri Foreman at Yankee Stadium. Cause I got him through someone at Yankee Stadium. And I just bought tickets to go to my first fight ever. And then I interviewed for the job and got the job, and it was an HBO fight. So it was interesting how I proactively went out of my way to go to a fight for the first time as an adult. And then, you know, I get this job in boxing, and HBO is an amazing place to really learn. Cause I came in as an assistant and had a mentor in this guy, Ray Stallone, who just had worked at NBC. He worked with Jordan through the Olympics and DePaul and all these great places. And he coached me for 8 years to make me, you know, to let me flourish to what I've, you know, now been able to do at other companies. And I mean, it was the place to be.
Greg, you being so young, man, because you're a baby, if you're 34, you're a baby. And where you're at right now, bro, do you look at yourself and go, are you the kind of guy that looks at yourself and go, fuck, man, I could do some real damage here, bro. I have, because I see it. I see superstar potential all over you, man. Do you feel that yourself or no?
Oh, every day. Every day. And I've watched some of your stuff, and I love your positivity, and that's like the mindset that I have every day. It's the mindset I have with my kids. Like, I'm that rah-rah dad who like wakes up and I'm like, you're amazing. You know what you're going to do today? You're going to crush it. That's what you're like. My daughter went to summer school today, and she's only six. So she doesn't really understand that summer school is not fun. But this morning she's like, she's like, oh, where's my class going to be? I'm like, it doesn't matter, because you're going to crush it and you're going to do amazing. And that's the mentality that I have. Like, I every day I could drive my wife a little crazy sometimes, because I'll just be like looking and thinking about the next thing and what's next and what I can do and the potential, and talking about, she calls me a dreamer, and that's exactly what I am. But, you know, the further you get into these things, like, dreams become reality as long.
Of course, dude. No, of course. And the hardest thing,
hey, every day.
What I find, Greg, the hardest thing with that is very few people can relate to me, because I'm operating in a different stratosphere, bro. Do you find that a lot?
I do a little bit, but I don't know, because I'm one of those. I am the type where I share with my wife and my kids and my closest confidants, but I'm not, because I know I have like this very cool job that a lot of my friends are, you know, may not be envious of, but you know, they work jobs where they're pushing paper or, you know, working with their hands or, you know, doing other things that maybe they don't love. And they know I have this job. I try my best to not be the guy that comes in and be like, oh, you know, I just got home from Houston. And, you know, I was with, you know, Logan Paul and Mayweather last week. Like I try not to, I don't know. I try not to dream too much around everyone, because it can sound a little boastful, you know, and that's never what I'm going for.
Exactly. And it's hard to relate. Like you said, man, majority of people don't take the risk. Majority of people don't get the luck either. Because a lot of this stuff it's weird, man. It's luck. You mentioned your daughters, dude. You seem like a phenomenal dad, bro. Like you're really, really, really into your kids. Do you wish you had a boy?
There's times where I do, but I wouldn't change the way our journey has gone at all. That's for sure. So I have two stepkids. I have a boy and a girl that I inherited in many ways from my wife had two kids, and I embraced that role as a very young man because I knew what I was stepping into, but I was in a position in my life where I knew I needed some balance. And this just happened to be the woman that I fell in love with, and kids weren't going to stop me from finding out if she was my soulmate, which, you know, I did find out. And so I have a boy, you know, I've guided him through so many moments in his life.
Got it.
So, and then we had a baby, and then, you know, we had a boy, but we had lost him sort of, you know, during pregnancy, and it wasn't meant to be. And now, you know, I have two beautiful little girls that, you know, they're everything to me. So, you know, I wouldn't change anything about how,
of course,
our journey has gone.
Greg, how old were you when you got married?
I was 28, I believe. I think we're coming up on our 7th anniversary.
No way, dude. I got married. I was lucky. I got married at 37, bro.
Okay.
I got married at 37. I have a girl who's 2 years old. Okay. Being a girl, dad. But then I have a boy who's just turned 8 months, man.
Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you, bro. And I could already tell the differences between one and the other. I never wanted to get married. I never wanted to have kids. To me, I wanted to be like Oprah and have everybody's kids be my kids, you know?
Yeah.
But it's interesting when a man, one of the best things in that, as I spoke more in colleges and in schools, Greg, and I into teams and organizations, it's funny how little we prepare men for the realities of life.
Yeah.
It's like they prepare us for like algebra, for these weird things, but they don't prepare us to deal with women while they're on their menstrual cycle. Or they don't prepare us to prepare women postpartum. They don't prepare us. Like, it's so many things that you got to kind of figure out on your own, which is crazy, man. How did you, growing up in the ranks of where you were, how have you been able to find marriage, bro? Has it been good for you? Have you been like, you know what? I was born for this. Have you had to make certain adjustments with your personality, anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone has to make adjustments. It's a great question though, because it's, you know, some of it's like how you control your emotions. Like I remember, like as a kid, I was like I went through a lot as like in my childhood, and it was a bit of a hothead at times. I remember when I was in high school playing football, I was the guy that was always like ready to step in and throw hands. I was that guy. And then, you know, as I matured, you just mature in your 20s. And I was always like, I said it before, like having, you know, lost my mom and dad young and seeing what my dad had went through, and he coached me in such a way to be like a good man. Like that was always his thing. Like he had always said, you know, be a good man, treat women, you know, with the utmost respect, you know, never speak out of hand to a woman. And then he also taught me the last thing, which was like, as he lost his ability to work with his hands, and that was his trade, he had always told me, find a job where you can work with your mind, because it's the last thing to go. And that was true in his case. And but you know, with marriage, it just, you know, I feel like you said born for it. I was like, I was born to be a dad. Like I really was. Like I wanted to have kids, especially I was like, I wanted to have kids young because who knows what's ever gonna happen. And I wanted to be like the able-bodied dad that, you know, is always around and doing things and able to just run up and jump and go to a playground and run around like crazy, or, you know, coach a soccer team or coach a baseball team or do whatever. And, you know,
Greg, have you coached them in anything yet sports wise?
I haven't. No, not yet. My daughter, my 6-year-old's really into gymnastics. So, you know, but, with my stepson, I was always like, I went to every single baseball game, never missed the baseball game when he was playing baseball, but I wasn't a coach.
You weren't a coach? Dude, no. I've worked with and I've spoken to a ton of girls' organizations and stuff like that. There is nothing in the world like coaching girl athletes. They're the best. They are the best. Oh, and when they're young,
they probably take instruction much better, right?
They go through fire for you, dude. Yeah. There's no complaining. They're super ultra competitive, man. It's not like the kids. And the funny part is that women know how to raise women. They're real good at that. With the boys, there's huge struggles. That's why you see a lot of, that's why you see it. That's why you sit there now and you say, like, man, I'm 34 years old. I'm crushing it and I'm doing this. And the people who aren't is because, especially the men, is because there's a big deficiency in how to raise boys and then turn them into men. Because it's weird, man. It's almost like, oh, there's this machismo and this tough bullshit attitude. No vulnerability, no honesty, because you got to keep that front, and then no adversity,
right,
which is what we need. You're winning because you have adversity all over your life. You obviously you didn't pick it, but you were able to come out of it in a certain way. That's why you're winning now. If not, you wouldn't even be close, you know?
Yeah, it's true. It's like you have to test. You have to not test them, but you have to let kids fail. Like, I know that's like a big thing. Like, you know, people write books about it and whatnot, but it's so hard, especially with it, you know, you if you have a privileged life where you know, you don't have to worry about paying the mortgage and, you know, getting food on the table. Like, it's hard to let your kids fail because, you know, how do you set them up for that? And it's so interesting you say that because you see it like a lot, like in my wife's family, like. You see the two different cultures, like being in a, you know, white family from New Jersey, right? And my wife's family being first generation from Nicaragua, and the, you know, being tough on kids and like not showing that vulnerability. Whereas like I'm the complete opposite, where I'm like the guy who's like out there, you know, kindergarten graduation, like, you know,
day,
you know?
Yeah.
And not the machismo. Like I have the machismo a little bit deep down in me, but I'm not afraid to show my vulnerability when it comes to like my kids and, you know,
that's
the
important. Things that no, it's I important, love, you know? Bro. Especially now, man. When you start, you make that transition now to the zone. I had no idea what the zone was.
Yeah.
But once I heard about it, I was like, man, this is super interesting. I've had is it Ed Hearn? Is that his name?
Eddie Hearn, yeah.
Eddie Hearn, I've had him on this show. Great dude. Did you work with him?
Yeah, I worked very closely with Eddie. And it was fascinating because I was at HBO for years and years. And, you know, having that, you know, it's a very comfortable place to be. You know, you keep getting promotions, you keep getting more money, do really cool things, you get comfortable with the people you're working with. But I said before, I always had that thing in me where I was looking for the next opportunity, right? The way to make HBO into my springboard. And HBO got out of boxing. They were getting out of boxing. DAZN had just signed Canelo. And I was at a conference, and this guy that I worked with at HBO had jumped over to DAZN about a month or two prior. And he said, hey, I want to link you up with my boss. He's trying to hire someone at the higher level. Can you, are you interested? And I said, yes. Because I knew at that point I was helping prep the release to say we were getting out of boxing. So I was like, yeah, I'm interested because I don't know. I might get fired tomorrow. I don't know.
That so is awesome.
I meet my former boss, this guy, Chris LaGentle. He's now the head of comms at the chief communications officer at WWE. And I meet him in a bar, the formal job interview I've ever had. So we're just sitting in a bar, had a couple beers, and basically leave the bar that night with a job offer to come join DAZN. And I jump over to DAZN, and it was such a liberating experience. And I say this all the time, especially now being over at Showtime, but it's like going from HBO, very long tenured organization in boxing. They're the pinnacle of the gold standard of boxing for 30 years. They get out of the sport, and now there's upstart app, DAZN. People don't even know how to pronounce it. DAZN, you know, all these things.
Right.
They come in and they go like, we're going to stream it. Like this is the way boxing is going, and we're going to spend a lot of money to do it. And we got Canelo, and it was like liberating because the structure that was there at HBO, there was structure at DAZN, but not quite as much because everybody was learning on the fly together. And they brought in all these very smart people from different areas of, you know, Goldman Sachs and Apple and all these people together. And it was just, it was a wild 2 years. And it was liberating because it gave me the chance to do things that I didn't really have the chance to do at HBO, like take risks and do big things. Like, you know, we just had wild ideas. And if you rose your hand and said, hey, I've got this crazy idea to, you know, put up a huge 100-foot screen at the border and stream the fight in Mexico for, you know, fans. And they'd be like, all right, yeah, cool, let's do it. You know, no one ever said no to a crazy idea. And that's what made it really fun. And working with Eddie's the kind of guy where he's also, he embraces disruption, which was the best thing about DAZN, just like disrupting the marketplace.
Greg, how do you feel then about Triller and the whole thing and what's happened to them with the YouTuber versus TikTok stuff? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think the TikTok YouTuber thing was outside of Triller, but I embrace everyone who's trying to give it a go because I love over my 10, 12 years in boxing now, I've just fell in love with the sport in a way that I couldn't have as a kid. And
right.
And there's so many good people in the sport, especially the athletes who have, you know, put their time and effort into becoming pro athletes and the sacrifice that goes along with it. If companies like Triller are going to come along and, you know, hand out big bags to people to do it, you know, all the power to them. I think it's exciting. And I frankly, as a fan, like I watched the Tyson Jones one, the first one where they had Wiz and all these other musical artists. Like, I think there's a place for that in boxing. People have tried it before. And I think they found a way to do it better than those who have done it before.
When you're there at DAZN, I met you, I emailed you first. And then I saw you briefly at the Paul Anderson Gibb fight.
Right, here in Miami.
Yep. And that event was done at a special place that doesn't exist here in Miami. That was all built.
The Meridian, yeah.
The Meridian, yeah. Go there. I'll take a picture there right now. It's empty.
I was in Miami for the Logan Paul Mayweather fight. And,
right.
And I got out of the airport and I'm taking that little ride down to Fifth Street Gym. And I drive past, I'm like, look, it's right next to the Children's Museum or whatever. Children's
Museum, yeah, man.
Right. And now there's nothing there. I remember going to the Meridian with Demetrius Andrade when we first announced, because he was the headliner that day. And we were announcing that Demetrius had just re-signed with DAZN. And I remember going there and they were building it. We were walking around and I just remember, like, I think I asked a couple of times, I'm like, how does this make any sense? Like, how does it make sense? And then the builder, the contractor was explaining, it's actually cheaper to just take all this equipment and just go around the city or go around the world or the country, excuse me, and just build up pop-up arenas for a couple nights and take sponsorship money in. And it's not as expensive as it looks, but that was quite an event,
first time doing it. And I remember just the way it was set up, man, it was awesome because the first thing was at Brickell City Center for the first talk and whatever. Then they did it on the beach, did a little pop-up thing on the beach and on the boardwalk there on the South Beach, and then the fight. And you could tell there with the energy and what was coming that this YouTube wave with any Paul brother is just amazing, man. And my theory with that is every time a Paul brother wins, the internet wins, which means people win. That's how I feel about it, dude. How do you view that?
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%. And it's interesting how quickly it's progressed too, because it's like, the, you know, when Jake Paul was fighting Anderson Gibb, I remember, you know, the day I took him to Super, it was right before the Super Bowl. So I took him to Super Bowl Radio Row, which is, you know, the hot spot of media, right? There's hundreds of radio stations there. You can essentially walk in with a celebrity and get him on any show, or, you know, Lines shows up. And I remember we had pitched him to ESPN, Fox Sports, Barstool, everywhere you can think of, all the top shows. And he wasn't embraced the way he is now, just 2 years later. Like, there were a lot of people who just said no. And you'd walk in, and we did an hour and a half of interviews. And I remember we were trying to hustle him around other places. But he just didn't have that seal of approval yet. And he beats Anderson Gibb pretty handedly, but no one really knew Gibb.
No one knew
And then he goes, and this is now pandemic times, right? He flattens Nate Robinson. And that was the moment on the undercard of Tyson Jones with that huge audience, million plus, that people were like, oh, this kid can fight. And
there's a problem. A problem here.
The problem child. And it's amazing now, because now he's fighting on Showtime in a couple weeks, in 8 weeks or so. And it's amazing to have watched to have been there at the first American event, the fight against Gibb, and how he was received to how he's being received just, I don't know, 18 months later. It's really tremendous from my side, because now everybody wants a piece of him. Now everybody wants either to have him on their show, or they want to fight him. And it's amazing, because he really works hard. And you know, his you know, is he as talented as, you know, Canelo? No, he's not. But he works hard, and he's figured out a way to bring eyeballs to boxing, and that's what's important.
1,000%, dude. So I got lucky, Greg. I went to every single Mayweather. So I lived in Vegas for 4 years.
Okay.
My trajectory is Cuba, Spain, Miami. Biggest failure in the history of Miami baseball by far. Played a little baseball. I am by far. I'll tell you why later. Biggest failure. Then from there, back to Miami. J-Lo discovers me. I'm modeling, puts me in a show that she was producing called South Beach with Vanessa Williams. I get my SAG card. I go, oh, this is perfect. I'm going to go become an actor in Los Angeles. So I lived in a car for 6 months in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Didn't know a single person, Greg. There's a real famous theater called the Groundlings Theater. It's an improv theater. The guy who created that, a guy by the name of Gary Austin, in the bio sheet that Wilhelmina gave me out there in Los Angeles, it said Gary Austin, founder of the Groundlings, which I didn't know what that was. But under it, it said when Helen Hunt won her Academy Award for As Good As It Gets, she thanked him. So I go, this guy has to be good. 6 months of living in my car. I haven't spoken to nobody other than the people at the gym. I was sneaking into the Equinox in West Hollywood. I was showering and shaved there. Greg, when I went to that guy's class, he's wearing a retro Houston Astros baseball jacket.
Okay.
I got this guy. I don't know too much, but I know I got this guy. Dude, we hit it off super well. Taught me stage presence. Taught me stuff that I would use now. I struggled in acting because I didn't have vulnerability. Okay. I got that way later. So I was robotic on a lot of things, and that wasn't my passion. But ironically, I become a celebrity baseball coach.
Okay.
Kind of working with mindset, and I figure out that I have the ability to tell very powerful, wealthy people that they're bullshitting with their kids and they got to change it.
And right.
In a way, like serious, like super, super big people, I say, listen, if you don't come see your kid at least once every two sessions that I work with him, I'm not working with him anymore.
Right.
Because I want him to see you. I don't want to see a bodyguard. I don't want to see a nanny, a maid. I want him to see you. And those kind of old school principles really put me in a different place. After 6 years, I was like, I'm not an actor. It's obvious. Wasn't my passion. But I moved to Las Vegas. And I start off as a promoter in a little club called Hyde in the Bellagio.
Okay.
And dude, from there I went to VP of Customer Development. And I, on a four-year run, unless you're one of the owners of the big companies, I was one of the most powerful guys in Las Vegas. And then I lived at the Mandarin Oriental, which is now the Waldorf Astoria there at the Aria. I lived there. I had the highest theoretical player in Vegas at the time. You know what theoretical play is?
No, I don't know what that is. What is that?
Are you a gambler? Do you gamble at all?
I do, but I'm not. I don't know what that means. I play some poker.
Okay. Poker doesn't count because poker is not considered a table game. So Vegas rates you, Greg, on this formula, which is called theoretical play. Average hand times how long you spend playing equals your theoretical play. So obviously, the higher the hand, the longer you're at the tables, the more Vegas says, this is our guy. We love you. We love you. We love you. So I had...
That's how I get the comps in Atlantic City, right.
Exactly, 1,000%. So my guy from Peru, he was a roulette guy. He averaged 330,000 a spin.
Ooh, Jesus Christ.
So we had, I sat probably third row, Canelo Mayweather, Mosley, all of them, bro. And I just sat, and I'm not really being, you know, about it. Just my guy was just the guy. So that was part of his comms, part of his whole thing, man. There's nothing like the energy of fighting, the vibe of it. What I think makes you special, man, and why, again, I think you're perfect for what you're doing is because here comes a guy in you that's super equipped to do what you do mentally and operationally. But when you add that you have a heart of gold and you actually care about people, now we're talking about, because if there's people that need a guy like you, are boxers, man. And I'm not talking about YouTube boxers. I'm talking about real boxers that like come from nothing, man. Yeah. How that heart, man, do you notice that makes you separate from everybody else?
Yeah. I appreciate that, first of all. But I think it's like a relatability thing too. I think it's just being able to, there's so many people, you know, not in just boxing, but in a lot of these sports that, you know, you walk around in a suit and tie all the time and you're very, you know, you dictate to them more than you talk to them. And over the years I've found it to just being relatable, and because as a PR guy, right, in this, my job is, you know, setting up interviews and setting up media blocks and getting guys who are now cutting 20, 30 pounds in training camp over 8 weeks, which is a very hard thing to do, to sit down and do 2 hours worth of interviews and, you know, grind over the same questions and say, and sometimes you just have to relate to them and go like, listen, I understand what you're doing, but you know, whenever it works for you, let's work on your schedule. Let's figure out a way that works best for you. Right. Like maybe it's not sitting down and doing, you know, 3 hours of interviews. Maybe it's, you know, giving back in your community. Maybe it's, you know, so I like to talk to guys like that. Like we have a guy that's about to fight September 11th on Showtime, Stephen Fulton Jr. He's 122 pound champ. He and I have, you know, become friends since I've been at Showtime and I've been working on his fights. And, you know, the other day he calls me and he's just like, I'm just trying to think about ways to give back like that. That's what I want to do during this camp. And, nice. You know, of course I'll do the interviews. Of course I'll do whatever I want. But like September, he's fighting on September 11th. He's like, I want to do something around September 11th. I want to do something around back to school. You know, these are the things I want to do. And he gave me that launching pad. And now I like, those are the things I really enjoy doing. Cause it's like, I could set up interviews with ESPN and Yahoo and all these other places, you know. That's just part of the job, but being able to think about how to do something really cool to give back, you know, to take guys to children's hospitals or Boys and Girls Club. We're trying to take Jermell Charlo to a Boys and Girls Club next week in San Antonio. Like those are the things that really, you know, separate, you know, some of these guys from others. And that's, you know, having that heart of gold, like you said, to give back and do things, because all of those things boost your presence and your brand. It gives you another, you know, layer to the brand that isn't just knocking people out for a living.
1,000%, dude. 1,000%, man. Greg, what's your favorite type of music?
My favorite type of music, I'm a rap fan.
Who's your favorite rap person or group?
My favorite rapper, I mean, it's got to be Jay-Z all time, probably.
Jay-Z, but, favorite Jay-Z song. Give me one favorite, that pops.
Probably, I Heart of the City was the first thing that came into my mind, but feeling it. I was listening to Reasonable Doubt with my friends this weekend over and over. So I've got the Reasonable Doubt ones. Feeling it is a great song. That's probably one of my favorites. And then now I try to listen to the new rap that the kids are listening to now. It's good running music. High BPM is just like, it's good. There's not much substance to it, but that's what you need when you're just trying to like run a 90 degree.
Absolutely, bro. Absolutely, man. Greg, I think, dude, not even in 5 years, man, you're going to be huge, bro. I see you, man, so special as a person and what you have. It's just, and I'm so proud of you with everything you've done in such short amount of time and stuff like that. To me, it's amazing, dude. Any questions for me, man? Anything I can help you with before I let you go?
No, I think I'm good. But I mean, I really appreciate you having me on, because this is I think the first time I've ever done an interview on the other side, and it's something that I've like you had said before, you talking to like kids and talking to, you know, going to high schools and stuff and doing those sorts of things. It's your profession, and I had the opportunity to do it a couple years ago. I went to my stepson's high school, which more inner city Jersey City school, and you know, had a chance to sit down and talk with the kids there and go, you know, I tell them sort of my story. I go, hey, you know, yeah, I'm, you know, I went to this school and I work at MLB and HBO and DAZN, and yeah, but underneath the facade of, you know, being a white suburban kid, there's a story, and it just lets you know. And as I tell them my story, they start to, you know, mouths drop, and they go like, damn, like, and it just makes you realize that everybody has, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, and that's a cliche, but like everyone has something going on, and people like you and I and you know, countless other people can use that message to help the next wave of you know, youth. Like, right, like you said, like young men need better role models, and if you don't get it at home, you need to get it somewhere, and if you don't, you know, it sets us on a path toward destruction, you know.
1,000%,
so, dude. I'm proud of what you're doing, man, and that's why I decided to come on with you, because I really love what you're doing, and the, you know, your mentality is the mentality I bring into my work and my, you know, life every single day.
I love it, dude. I love it, dude. All right, man, don't go anywhere. Hold on, I'm gonna say bye to you the right way. Okay, hold on 1 second.
Cool.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.